Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
Virginia's first governor indictment, a challenge to Virginia's ban on gay marriage, and lawmakers in week three of the General Assembly. I'm May Lily Lee. Thanks for joining us. We'll discuss all of these events, but we begin with the federal indictments filed against former Governor Bob McDonnell and his wife, Maureen. The 14-count indictment alleges the McDonnells illegally accepted gifts and loans from businessman and political donor Johnny Williams. The indictments claim the McDonnells accepted more than $165,000 in gifts, loans, and trips from Williams in exchange for helping promote his dietary supplement business. Bob McDonnell says he did nothing illegal and vows to use every available resource to fight what he terms false allegations. If convicted, the McDonnells face the possibility of fines in excess of $1 million and prison time. Bob McDonnell is the first Virginia governor ever indicted on criminal charges. The indictments were not a total surprise to some Richmond insiders, yet still sent shockwaves through the Capitol and beyond. And joining us today to discuss the charges and the impact on this year's session, we welcome our Richmond studio, Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist with the Richmond Times-Dispatch. And by phone from Harrisonburg is Dr. Robert Roberts, JMU professor of political science. Welcome to you both. And Bob, I want to start with you. Bob McDonnell is not the first governor to accept large gifts from donors while in office. He just seems to be the first one to be in the line of fire.
That's true. I mean, in fact, we have a history in this state of very, very lax gift acceptance. In other words, the rule currently applied to the new governor has changed it. But you could take a gift as long as you did not believe that that gift would influence you in making a decision. Therefore, governors have taken gifts. But this is different because what the federal government is alleging that in addition to taking the gift, you agreed to do something in return for it. See, that's the difference. You can take gifts, but you can't agree to use your official position in return for the gift. And I think that's where we see the difference here.
And I want to read the statement that was issued by the former governor. He says, the federal government's case rests entirely on a misguided legal theory, and that is that facilitating an introduction or a meeting, appearing at a reception, or expressing support for a Virginia business is a serious federal crime if it involves a political donor or someone who gave an official gift. That's a statement he made after his official release.
Right.
Let's talk about that, because that really fine-tunes things. He is trying to address, almost in a way here, I'm doing what everyone else has done.
Yeah.
This is the way things are done in Virginia.
Yeah, but to understand what is happening here, you have to go back to the history of these statutes. Federal prosecutors began using the mail fraud statute or wire fraud statute and the Hobbs Act to go after corrupt state and local public officials in the 1970s. The Supreme Court has issued a number of decisions interpreting how federal prosecutors are to use these statutes. In other words, there's a ton of case law. And what's unique about these statutes, they weren't designed to go after state and local public officials. They were, in a sense, used or adapted to deal with the fact that states and local governments would not police their own officials. The mail fraud statute and the Hobbs Act require proof of a quid pro quo. It just requires, in particular, the Hobbs Act only requires, according to the Supreme Court, that there's an agreement. In other words, that the giver of the gift and the public official reach an agreement that that public official is to do something in return for the money. That official does not have to carry through with the agreement. Let me say that again. To get convicted of the Hobbs Act, there doesn't have to be any evidence, but there has to be an agreement. If you agree to, let's say, call somebody up at a department and say, will you look into this matter, or agree to have your aide theoretically contact UVA or VCU to see if they might do a study on your dietary supplement, current interpretation of the Hobbs Act might permit you to be found guilty. And see, that's what they're disagreeing. They're disagreeing on legal interpretation of the statute. And that's going to be up to the judge to decide how broadly or how narrowly he or she is going to allow that statute to be interpreted.
And for the purposes of clarity, I'm going to read a quote from his original release. This is what Bob McDonnell said. My fellow Virginians, earlier today, federal prosecutors notified my attorneys that they were filing criminal charges against me and my wife. And then it goes on to say, I repeat emphatically that I did nothing illegal for Mr. Williams in exchange for what I believed was his personal generosity and friendship.
Right.
I never promised any government benefit of any kind from me or my administration.
Right. And so the crux of the case in both these statutes is they must prove there was an agreement, that he agreed to do something on behalf of on his behalf, using his state power to help Mr. Williams' dietary supplement company.
Now let's talk about what's going on with the General Assembly. A bipartisan group of Virginia House members unveiled an ethics reform proposal Tuesday. Some people say it was a little on the weak side, or at least weaker than expected. Major reforms include this, and I'd like to discuss this with you, a $250 cap on tangible gifts to officials and to their immediate family. Up until now, you could give gifts to family members without needing to disclose that.
Correct.
Let's go back to the tangible issue, however. A tangible gift is very different from a trip or a dinner or an excursion somewhere, golf outing.
Yeah, it's clearly not enough. I mean, if you compare, and we're dealing with two different branches of government. We're dealing with the executive branch, and then we're dealing with the legislative branch, and then judicial in theory. The rules historically have been somewhat different between the legislative branch and the executive branch. So what we're talking about here, I think we're talking now about what rules should apply to the legislative branch. And the rules that they're proposing really are far too weak in comparison to what other states have. Normally what you do is you come up with something called a prohibited source. And what a prohibited source is someone who is has an interest in what you're doing in the legislature. In other words, for example, Dominion Power, for example. Dominion Power has, and I'm not singling out Dominion Power, but it may have interest in laws coming out or regulations coming out regarding how the power companies operate. In that case, if I've got a donor and I've got legislation before me that theoretically might relate to my donor, I should not be able to take a gift. In most states, you can't. So in a sense, this is a very narrow expansion of the gift acceptance rules for the legislative branch, and probably should be much broader. But there's a lot of pressure not to do it, because legislators in this state have historically, and I don't want to use this term derogatorily, but felt entitled to take things. And I think they felt entitled because they were part-time legislators. They weren't making a lot of money being a legislator. It took time to do their job. And that these perks, in a sense, made it easier to be a legislator, and they didn't feel they did anything for them. And therefore, if I'm elected, I deserve these things. And they don't want to take them away. And simply, they don't want them to go away because they view that they were entitled to them. And it's very difficult for someone to give up something when you've taken them for such a long time.
Let's talk about those other states. And you are also on that bandwagon. These reforms seem to be weaker than expected. What would be a tighter, more comprehensive reform package?
A more tighter comprehensive reform package. For example, back in 1992, Governor Wilder had appointed an ethics commission. And that ethics commission came up with a very comprehensive set of reform proposals in December of 92. It was like 40 pages long, and it was very, very detailed. And what it would be is you can't take a gift, okay, over a certain amount, period. But you can't take a gift from any source that has an interest in what's before the legislature. That would be a comprehensive ban. In other words, if it's a company that's regulated by the state of Virginia, you can't take it. If you have a company that may have legislation pending before the state or the legislature, you can't take it. In the sense, if there's any interest in that source in what's before the legislature, you can't take it. In a sense, and that would wipe out almost huge percent of the gifts that legislators would take. In a sense, they can lobby you, okay? They can come to your office. They can call you up on the phone. But they can't give you things, and that's what they should be doing. You have an outright ban on any gift from any source that has any interest before the legislature. Or regulated by the executive branch. And that would be a simple rule to deal with, and it would not work an undue hardship on most legislators. Why they don't do it? Because they want to keep the stuff.
Jeff, a lot of people say that this will be a first test for the new governor to see how he heralds ethics reform in his administration. What's your opinion?
I think there's a missing piece to all of this. Virginia has a part-time citizen legislature. There is some reluctance to clamp down on the rules. I think in part the feeling is it will discourage people from standing for office. There may be something to that. But I think, frankly, that a lot of the legislators don't want to criminalize this behavior. Because they don't want to find themselves in an equally calamitous predicament. I mean, equally calamitous to Bob McDonald and Maureen McDonald's predicament. Outright bans sound good. Perhaps would work. I'm wondering if part of this is to substantially, and I mean substantially, increase legislative compensation. The games that go on the salary side are considerable because our legislators are receiving about $18,000 a year, just under $18,000 in the House, $18,000 among the senators.
And the governor makes around $175,000, roughly.
The governor makes $175,000, all of those salaries set by law. Terry McAuliffe is not someone who needs the money, so it's certainly a lot easier for him to swear off all of this stuff and to indicate that, at least as far as he is concerned, his family and his staff, that no one will accept anything worth $100 or more. So I think ethics reform, again, whatever that is, has to be examined through another lens, and that is the lens of legislative compensation.
I agree with Jeff, but the problem with that approach is that by allowing all this money to go to legislators in terms of gifts, it creates the appearance that many of these legislators are under undue influence by these special interests. And this is the problem every state faces, that these legislators, in a sense, are more concerned about keeping the gifts going. And it may not be the case. It may be, you know, they take the gifts and they're not doing any favors. But it creates that appearance to a lot of voters, a lot of citizens, who become very cynical about, you know, are these legislators actually representing their interest, or are they representing the interests of special interests? And to put an outright ban would not be difficult. We wouldn't have to criminalize it. In a sense, we wouldn't have to attach criminal penalties to this. We could attach sanctions, legislative sanctions to them, or in a sense they would be censured or something like that. We don't need to. I would be opposed to criminalizing it, but at least it would be out in the public that they did this, that they shouldn't have done it. And that they would be put on, the voters would know that they shouldn't have done it. So I think the argument that you clearly don't want to criminalize all this, but on the other hand, to deal with the fact that they're part time, increase their per diem. In other words, they get a per diem now, increase their per diem to cover their expenses. They don't need to take football tickets from universities. I'm sorry. They don't need to go to a university and get free football tickets. Why are they entitled to that? In other words, those things can be dealt with, but they don't want to deal with them. And I think that's simply they don't want to deal with it. They don't want to give up these perks.
Here's a side note I just want to insert because it grabbed my attention. It was an excerpt from an email by Maureen McDonnell in which she writes, quote, Bob is screaming about the thousands I'm charging up in credit card debt. We are broke and have an unconscionable amount in credit card debt already, and this inaugural is killing us. That's a person who needs that handout.
Correct.
Take a moment here just to go to Alan from Charlottesville. He has some reaction to the indictments. Good morning, Alan.
Oh, yes. Good morning. I just want to say I think most people do not care about the interpretation of the Hobbs Act with regard to McDonald or any other politician. His problem is that he built his career on the perception that he's a squeaky, clean Christian gentleman. Bill Clinton and Chris Christie, for example, who have committed heinous acts, arguably, are going to be fine because they never presented themselves as squeaky, clean Christian gentlemen. This is McDonald's problem. He should have been contrite, perhaps even resigned. I think if he had resigned, this would all be, or if he had simply apologized, I think this would all be history. That's the biggest mistake he makes. He's a hypocrite. You cannot say you're a squeaky clean Christian gentleman and do what he has done. He should have simply stepped down. I don't understand why that's so difficult for people. Forget the lawyers. That's just basic common ethical sense, is it not?
Thank you so much, Alan, for your call.
There are a couple of points that I think Alan raises that might be explored. The governor apologized on a number of occasions, clearly hoping he could indemnify himself with federal investigators. That doesn't seem to have persuaded them at all. The governor, for the most part, was held, at least according to public opinion polls, in fairly high regard by Virginians during the kind of very quiet lapses in this or breaks, if you will, in this very long and painful process. He has indeed presented the image of Boy Scout-like earnestness. This is certainly a red flag in that respect. But one of the reasons I suspect the governor was disinclined to resign, not only because it would suggest to the electorate that somehow he had done something wrong, but he didn't want to give up the income.
Oh, absolutely.
This is a man who, at least according to these emails, And arithmetic would suggest that the McDonald's were under considerable financial stress even before all of this. Five children, all to be educated, daughters to marry off. There was a lot of pressure on the family budget.
We're talking with Jeff Shapiro of the Richmond Times-Dispatch and Rob Roberts of JMU, and you're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Next week, the new words added to our lexicon in 2013, and your thoughts on some of the questionable ones. Stay with us. We'll be back with more on what's happening in Richmond in just a moment. Welcome back to Virginia Conversations. I'm A. Lily Lee. We're joined by Rob Roberts of JMU and Jeff Shapiro of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. We've been talking about Tuesday's indictments against the McDonald's. Indeed, a bombshell. However, it wasn't the only bombshell in Richmond this week. Yesterday, Attorney General Mark Herring made a bold public statement about his stance on gay marriage in Virginia.
After thorough and independent review, I have concluded that Virginia's ban on marriage between same-sex couples violates the due process and equal protection clauses of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. As Attorney General, I cannot and will not defend a law that violates Virginians' fundamental constitutional rights.
After only 11 days in office, Attorney General Herring announced he would join the lawsuit against Virginia's ban on same-sex marriage. Rather than defend the law on behalf of the state, he will side with plaintiffs challenging the state. On NPR's Morning Edition, Herring told Steve Inskeep his job is to defend laws that are constitutional. He believes this one is not. Herring says he wants his state to be on the right side of history. And in that interview, he also explained why he changed his view on the subject.
I had voted against marriage equality 8 years ago back in 2006, even though at the time I was speaking out against discrimination and ways to end discrimination, and I was wrong for not applying it to marriage. I saw very soon after that how that hurt a lot of people, and it was very painful for a lot of people. After that, I talked to a lot of people, constituents I represented as a state senator, co-workers, my family, including my children, and I come to see the issue very differently now.
You said your children. What did your children tell you?
Well, I think they were instructive about the relationships that people have, and they were helpful in getting me to see a different perspective.
How did they phrase that? Come on, Dad. What did they say?
You know, they pressed me for the position I had taken and made me continue to question it, and I just came to the conclusion that it was the right thing to do.
I want to start off by saying this seems to steal a little thunder from McAuliffe. You'll recall that during his campaign for governor, he said that he would sign an executive order relating to equal treatment of the LGBT community. On Inauguration Day, he signed that executive order, the one that he had promised. He said, quote, "My administration is committed to keeping Virginia open and welcoming to all who call our Commonwealth home. He wants to ensure equal opportunity in the workplace, no matter their backgrounds, race, religion, or whom they love." So there's there was a bit of that, and now the Attorney General has come out with his opposition to the ban on gay marriage.
And while it seems quite a splash, and I probably would not quarrel with suggestions that it is, this is not unprecedented conduct, behavior, an unprecedented course of action for a Virginia Attorney General. A Republican attorney general named Jerry Kilgore, who stood unsuccessfully for governor, announced that he would not defend, this is going back to the early 2000s, a constitutional provision that prohibited churches from incorporating. And that was a pronouncement made to a federal judge who was considering a challenge to that language brought by a ministerial figure, a religious figure of some consequence in Republican circles, Jerry Falwell. Before that, in 1996, Mary Sue Terry, who had been defending Virginia Military Institute's males-only admissions policy, then dropped that case after Governor Wilder, then-Governor Wilder, had said that single-sex admissions policy was at least in his view, indefensible, illegal, and unconstitutional. At that point, of course, the representation of VMI was turned over to a private law firm. Let's cut to the chase here. Republicans are very concerned about this because within substantial circles within the Republican Party, gay bashing is the preferred course. As General Herring indicated, or certainly implied in conversations with his children about this issue, among younger Virginians, Republican, Democrat, and independent, the idea of same-sex civil marriage is just not a big deal. These are distinctions that mean nothing to this new wave of Virginians. And clearly, Mark Herring is trying to stay in sync with that new wave of Virginians because his political ambitions hang on it. This is someone who could be standing for governor in 4 years.
I think it's more complex than even that, because what happens with Herring, what he did, for example, we have a case in Harrisonburg that is proceeding more quickly than the Norfolk case. It's been heard already. The judge has the case, maybe decided in the next couple of months. If that judge decides to strike down the 2006 constitutional amendment, if Herring refuses to represent that and, in a sense, challenge it, the question remains, who has standing to challenge it? In other words, who has standing to take that decision to the Fourth Circuit? In other words, if the Attorney General refuses to, who can challenge it? If a federal court decides, let's say someone attempts to intervene on behalf of whatever, the state, and goes before the Fourth Circuit and says, I want to defend this statute, the Fourth Circuit may say, you don't have standing to. Only the Attorney General can challenge it. And then what would happen is that we would have gay marriage in Virginia. In other words, within a fairly short period of time, there would be no delay. There would be no appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. It would be law in Virginia. And so this decision has significance far beyond just the political significance of it. There's a practical legal significance refusing to do that.
And to Professor Roberts' point on standing, which is a highfalutin way of someone saying they have a legitimate interest in a legal dispute because they are a potentially injured party.
Right.
This is why Todd Gilbert, one of the House Republican leaders, has introduced legislation that would allow the General Assembly to intervene in these actions in the absence of the Attorney General. Federal law is very different, and this has been a sticky procedural question on this issue for some time. It is. I'm not trying to dismiss the significance of the Attorney General's action. This is has been an option available to the state for some time, and it was something that was explored in the press in some detail even before the election. If I may put in a plug for the Times Dispatch.
Oh, absolutely. And so I was surprised it didn't get more attention during the campaign. That this very well could happen. It was probably going to happen. And Gilbert's bill is interesting. It would probably, and I think. If it went before the, in terms of being challenged, first of all, I doubt McAuliffe would sign it, giving the legislature a standing to sue. And then what will happen is someone will try to intervene on behalf of the state, and the Fourth Circuit will have, if it's struck down, the Fourth Circuit will have to decide who to give standing. They could give standing, but for the precedent in California was the Supreme Court sent back the case from California because they found that the interveners in California, who was not the Attorney General, did not have standing. So gay marriage is law in California. And so the significance of this is just, like I was saying, just not, politics. In other words, appealing to the new Democratic base, and Jeff is absolutely correct. The new Democratic base is heavily, particularly young voters, supportive of what he did. And the Democrats have to have those voters come out. Particularly in the upcoming 2014 Senate race, Mark Warner will need those voters to come out. And Mark Warner on radio and our local radio, public radio station here yesterday, said he was supportive of gay marriage, and therefore the fate of the Democratic Party in the future hangs upon getting these young voters out, and they deeply believe in this issue.
We have a pro and a con. Here's a comment in support of his move from Senator Tim Kaine. He said, quote, I applaud Attorney General Herring for taking an important step to challenge Virginia's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. As governor, I opposed this discriminatory amendment and agree it's time for Virginia to be on the right side of history with respect to marriage rights. However, opponents criticized the move, including House Speaker Bill Howell. He said, quote, less than 2 weeks ago, Mark Herring took an oath and swore to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of Virginia. I am very concerned about his announcement and the dangerous precedent it sets with regard to the rule of law.
It doesn't set a dangerous precedent because the Attorney General is not there to enforce unconstitutional laws. And the Virginia Attorney Generals have not done that, as Jeff explained. They have an obligation as an officer of the court, in fact, not to enforce unconstitutional laws. And, in fact, Virginia Attorney Generals have a history of doing that. And
well, forget for a moment that this is the public's lawyer. Let's just say this was a lawyer, a private
right.
lawyer, and you were seeking advice on how to proceed in a controversy. It would be that lawyer's responsibility to tell you, look, under the law, you have a good chance of winning or you have a better chance of losing.
Right.
By the way, currently 17 states and the District of Columbia allow gay couples to marry. We're a purple state. Who knows? We have a call from Portsmouth. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to say that I have been opposed from the beginning to the Marshall Newman constitutional amendment. I think that the Loving versus Virginia case that overturned the law against marrying interracially is really the pertinent precedent. And the other piece of it is unprecedented for passing a constitutional amendment that deprives citizens of their rights. The first 10 amendments to the Constitution of the United States were adopted to protect the rights of citizens. This is really a case of people voting their prejudices. Thanks.
We appreciate your call, Mark. And Louise from Orange has a little bit of an opposing view on that. Go ahead. You're on the air, Louise.
Hello there. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm just sick and tired of hearing all this talk about ethics and stuff and morals. And, you know, the way I look at it is if you have to question it, then it's probably immoral, which is probably why there's so much fuss about gay marriage, abortion. I mean, if it was morally okay to do those things, why the big fights all the time? I'm just sick and tired of hearing it. I'm opposed to gay marriage. Always will be. It's just plain, flat, simple wrong. I can go on into reasons for it, but I don't have enough time to talk about it because I actually have a very high interest in this type of study. But it's just simply wrong. I mean, how can anyone just say it's okay for two men to get married or two women to get married? It's ridiculous. I don't understand it. I think I heard a caller earlier this morning talk about Governor McDonald's problem was that he claimed to be a Christian gentleman. Okay, that's fine. Well, what about our new governor, who also claims to be a Christian? He's also a Catholic, and he's pro-abortion, pro-gay marriage. That's anti-Christian. So, to me, it seems that liberals, it's do as I say, not as I do. You know, liberals don't understand anything like that. Liberals don't understand morality or ethics. They have very little room to speak.
We appreciate your call, Louise. Thanks so much for calling in.
Okay.
As for the politics of this, there's pressure on the left. Certainly Democrats are encouraged to take certain stands on same-sex marriage, on abortion. And there is comparable pressure on the right among Republicans, a good deal of pressure to stand in opposition to same-sex marriage and abortion rights. There is the wild card, if I may introduce this, of redistricting. We have these made-to-order districts that empower the narrowest bands of the electorate, right and left. And this is keeping a lot of pressure on legislators, Democratic and Republicans, to take very, if you will, conventional stands. These stands on these issues are articles of faith within, pun intended, among Democrats and Republicans. Perhaps if we didn't have such anti-competitive districts, we might have a more interesting conversation on some of these issues, and perhaps some interesting solutions, maybe a bit more practical solutions.
We might, but I think there's a deeper change in the parties, because if you look at all the data about the Republican Party right now, who their constituents are, who are Republicans, and who are Democratic supporters, the difference between the religiosity of Democrats and Republicans has become great. In other words, the Republican Party has moved to, in a sense, more than at any time in American history, to have a very, very, very close relationship with very religious people. and very religious people, many of them, don't like gay marriage. Now, the problem with that position is, in a society where we're supposed to have separation church and state, those religious beliefs are not supposed to be setting public policy. No one is saying that a church has to marry somebody. I think that we forget about that. Marriage is a civil function. It is not a religious function under the law. Churches can marry, but the fact of getting married, the law regarding marriage, is a civil function. And therefore, there's a lot of confusion in terms of a lot of very conservative Christians are very offended by gay marriage, but they forget that we're not saying that their churches have to marry somebody. All we're saying is under civil law, there's not a rational basis for preventing same-sex couples from marrying. It's very simple. There's no state rational basis for doing that.
By the way, if one looks over the long history of Virginia, despite Mr. Jefferson's famous pronouncement in the Danbury letter about the wall between church and state, there are many, many examples in Virginia law that reflect, if you will, the continuing religiosity within the governed. People were presumed to be virtuous, or it was hoped that they would be virtuous, and it was hoped that that sense of virtue was grounded in their faith.
Well, I agree. But the modern interpretation of the Constitution, beginning with the Warren Court and the separation church and state, which I don't think Jefferson would have disagreed. I think Jefferson was writing before the Great Awakening, where you had the tremendous increase in religious adherence in this country after Jefferson died. That in a sense we forget that, and therefore the idea that religious groups want to influence public policy isn't new. The question is that the courts are beginning to say that they shouldn't.
All right. We have some more callers on hold, and we'll be sure to get to you after this break. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. This reminder that past editions of Virginia Conversations can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org and like us on Facebook. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
And welcome back to Virginia Conversations. Today we're talking about the recent developments in Richmond. Our guests are Dr. Robert Roberts, JMU Professor of Political Science, and Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist with the Richmond Times-Dispatch. First thing I want to do is check on Kyle. Let's see. Are you still there in Virginia Beach?
Yes.
Good.
Thank you.
Thanks for your patience.
Morning.
Good morning, yes. Kyle.
I'd like to expand upon Professor Roberts' comment about the acceptance of money, giving at least the perception that our legislators are giving more preference to the people giving the money than they are the average citizen. And I'd like to take that beyond the realm of ethics and take it to our election system, where we have basically legalized corruption, where we allow companies, especially in the wake of Citizens United, to just pump as much money into elections as they want to, and then have undue influence over our legislators because of it. And just one prime example would be the fossil fuel industry, how much money they contribute to election campaigns, and therefore we see no substantive moves to prevent climate change. That would just be one example. And so I think the whole system needs to be reformed where it doesn't take so much outside money to run an election. So it would take more investment by the public in paying our legislators what they earn and, taking the money out of politics.
Yeah. Kyle, thanks for chiming in.
Jeff is aware of this, that Virginia is one of the four states in the country that its campaign finance laws permit corporations, and this has nothing to do with the Citizens United case, to make direct contributions to candidates. That is just not done in almost every state in the country. A corporation or a union can make direct contributions under state law to state candidates directly. They don't have to put it through a PAC. They can give it to you, Dominion Power, anybody, which is just not acceptable in terms of political ethics. And Citizen United had nothing to do with that. What Citizen United permits you to do is independently spend money, but not directly. We permit corporations to spend directly in campaigns, and that has a terribly corrupting influence on Virginia politics.
Okay, let's move back to the gay marriage ban issue, and we're going to get a little bit of an opinion from Kirk, a little bit from Rita, and then we'll move on to some other General Assembly news. Good morning, Kirk. Thanks for joining our conversation.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning. You're coming to us from the Eastern Shore, is that right?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you. I think it's kind of interesting that a couple over the summer when they were talking about increasing gun control, that you had a lot of elected officials jumping up and down on the right screaming, we're not going to enforce this unconstitutional law. And now it's on the left that the same thing is going on. So it's certainly not a novel concept that elected officials will stand up and say that they're not going to enforce something that they think is unconstitutional. And it obviously happens on both sides of the spectrum. But then also, just a quick comment, as a young voter, in regards to the whole religion thing, it seems like a lot of the most recent election seems to me like a pretty good mandate that people in the state are not necessarily interested in being governed by people who are could be seen as religious fanatics regarding some things, and it showed, and I think it's going to continue to show. And young people, many young people, are equally passionate about equal rights as older people are about having their religion legislated to everyone. So,
thank you so much, Kirk. And now Rita from Newport News. Welcome to the show. Hi, Rita.
Hi. I was just calling in to follow up on, I think his name was Ms. Lewis's remarks. I am a Christian, and just because, you know, people get up and protest and say that, you know, something's wrong doesn't mean it is wrong. He was saying, you know, if there's so much controversy over it, it must be wrong to begin with. I mean, look at civil rights, you know.
You're in support of gay marriage.
I support this movement toward gay marriage, and I think, you know, you can be a Christian and still support those things. He doesn't speak for all Christians.
Thanks, Rita. And in fact, Sarah, we want to give you an opportunity, too, and then we'll close out that topic before we move on. Sarah, you're on the air. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Oh, thanks for calling me in. Yes, I've been listening to the program, and thank you so much for having the topic and the discussion. I'm a Christian myself. I'm a seminary student, and I just heard the comment from the person in orange and was just very saddened to hear that view expressed and that people might think that Christians are, you know, across the board condemning gay marriage, whereas I've found the opposite. In fact, that many of the Christians I know are deeply moved by the struggle that LGBTQ people in our country and around the world go through and just believe that, you know, equality needs to move forward. And some of the most devout Christians that I know are gay, and that this discussion has been so fruitful because, you know, talking about what the meaning of marriage actually is, not just primary means of biological procreation, but in terms of loving, committed partnership and sharing a life together and having that union blessed by God. It's something that I'm so passionate about, and I did not want that one view from the person in orange to be the only one expressed from a religious perspective.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for calling in. You, in fact, got the last word on that topic among our callers. Jeff, did you have one more thing?
To note that, of course, same-sex marriage has been an issue within religious organizations, the Episcopal Church, for example, and that has had a ripple effect here in Virginia that ended up in the courts. And it was something in which Bob McDonnell was deeply involved as Attorney General. Because of these divisions among those within the Anglican Communion, parishes, Episcopal parishes, very conservative Episcopal parishes, wanted to leave the church and take their property with them. But the Episcopal Church, being a hierarchical organization, assets are deemed the property of the whole church. This went into the courts under a somewhat ancient statute in the code of Virginia, and that was rooted in disagreements within church organizations over slavery. Bob McDonnell, then Attorney General, intervened in behalf of these churches. It was the expressed position of the Commonwealth that these breakaway churches were correct. So there are it was not a case in which the churches were successful. The Attorney General's intervention, I suspect, had more to do with assuring or reassuring his faith supporters or faith-based supporters. But there have been entanglements in Virginia history, over Virginia history, involving church and state that have little to do with matters of faith and have a lot to do with politics.
For our remaining moments, we'll talk one more time about the indictments against the McDonnells, and then we'll move on to some of the issues relating to the General Assembly, what's before the GA this year. Let's start with Mary's call. Good morning to you, Mary.
Good morning.
You're in Grayson County?
I am.
Welcome.
I just wanted to comment, and I don't know who said it because I was doing something else and I kind of caught the end of it, about the deeply religious deeply religious population primarily as being opposed to gay marriage. And I just wanted to say that I think that is perhaps a misnomer. There are a number of people who are deeply religious, as a couple of the previous callers have alluded to, who are Christian. And then there are those of us who do not consider ourselves Christian who do support gay marriage, and I think and also are deeply religious in our faith. So I think that that should not be confused. Deeply religious and people who oppose gay marriage are two separate
I will correct my statement. What I meant was within certain elements of primarily evangelical Christians, that they find gay marriage as a offense to their faith. And so that might be within, you could be deeply religious and pro-gay marriage, but within a certain segment of the evangelical Christian population, it is considered quite offensive, and many of those deeply religious evangelical Christians are Republicans. So I stand corrected.
Well, I would agree with that. I think the clarification, though, is helpful because
yes.
It kind of got my attention.
No, you're correct. I misspoke.
Thank you so much, Mary. We appreciate your call. And let's take a look at one of the big issues on the table before the GA, in light of the stabbing of Senator Cree Deeds. He has, among others, submitted bills relating to improving the state's mental health system. State Senator Cree Deeds' agenda for the 2014 session includes proposals that would create a psychiatric bed registry and expand the time limit for emergency custody orders relating to people dealing with mental health issues. Let's talk about, first of all, there are so many, but it seems like Cree Deeds' is going to have a little bit more weight based on his personal experience.
No, I agree. But the problem with all these proposals, and I think Jeff would probably agree, that there is just not enough money being spent on mental health in this state. Virginia was back in the, for much of Virginia's 20th century, Virginia had a very high rate of institutionalization of the mental people with mental illness. We had huge mental hospitals, Western State, Eastern State, And when the federal courts began to order deinstitutionalization of these facilities, basically you couldn't keep people in these state facilities unless they were a threat to someone else or themselves, we dumped them out into the communities without sufficient money to take care of them. We can talk about all the reforms we want in terms of more beds. If we don't have money to pay for psychiatrists, to pay for mental health professionals, none of that will make any difference. And I don't see anything in the legislature that they're willing to put in enough money to really make a large difference. So,
mental health has always been something of a stepchild in Virginia government, going back to the late 40s, Bill Tuck, very conservative, Byrd Organization Democrat, tried to raise taxes because he wanted to do something about the mental health system. That didn't go anywhere. I think for the most part, and Virginia may not be unique in this respect, the state tends to react to the problems and the challenges facing its mental health system as opposed to acting. Senator Deed's tragic experience puts a very, very clear face on this issue. It is, however, again, a reaction. And when one considers that it was only 6 years ago following the awful news out of Virginia Tech that Virginia thought it was closing many of the holes in its mental health safety net. And we're learning that that's just not the case.
Let's talk now a little bit about party control of the Virginia Senate, just by way of background. Democrats last year swept all three statewide constitutional offices, and they already held both U.S. Senate seats, Tim Kaine and Mark Warner. So one would think that there is a lot of Democratic control, but when you look at those three races, two of them were barely won by the Democrats.
Well, of course, in Virginia, we have an election every year, and every election has a different electorate. The lower turnouts in statewide elections tend to favor the Republicans. Now, that's not always the case, as certainly last year's Democratic sweep, the first since 1989, indicates. But to the issue of legislative control, there is redistricting. There are boundaries drawn to create certain types of districts. Those boundaries seem to have worked. On the Senate side, where the districts tend to be larger and there is this even division, two senators were elected statewide, Ralph Northam, Lieutenant Governor, Mark Herring, Attorney General. The Democrats are hoping to hold both seats, preserve that tie with tiebreaker Ralph Northam sitting as president of the Senate. That's the Lieutenant Governor's job. Casting tie-breaking votes on important organizational matters. For example, who chairs committees? What are the number of seats on committees? Who actually sits on committees? So assuming that Linwood Lewis's nine-vote majority for the Ralph Northam Senate seat, Linwood Lewis, a Democrat from the Eastern Shore, that he's seated sometime next week, look for the Democrats to use their 21 votes to force some changes. It's not going to do anything to improve the atmosphere in the Senate. Collegiality has faded as partisanship has risen. It'll make for great copy, and it'll make for some interesting engagements on issues that may not have been making it to the floor because of Republican organizational dominance.
But, Jeff, is that permissible? I've been told by some wide-grout experts that under the rules of the Senate, once the Senate committees are set at the beginning of the session, that you can't change them later.
There's a disagreement on this. The Democrats' position is that ultimately the majority is responsible for the organization of the Senate, and if that changes even in midterm, that would be the prerogative of the new majority. If you look at some of the rules that are involved here, there are clearly opportunities for the Democrats. There is very little litigation on this issue. Remember,
right,
the Democrats pressed a court to get involved in this when the Senate organized after the 2011 elections, and the court said, look, this is a political issue. You all figure it out. So the Republicans might, trump off to a court this time. I suspect they'd get the same answer.
Or might the Republicans just say, we're not going to participate in legislative business if you do this? In other words, that's a less judicial approach. But in a sense, the most significant part of that is if the Democrats get control of the organization, they would appoint the conferees to the Budget Committee, correct?
That would be among their prerogatives. My guess is, and just strictly a guess, is that if the Senate Finance Committee may actually have co-chairs if there is this new organizational scheme. Power sharing.
That's all the time we have.
Okay.
For this edition of Virginia Conversations, I want to thank our guests, JMU Professor Robert Roberts, and from the Richmond Times-Dispatch, Jeff Shapiro. Thanks to you for listening and joining in today's conversation. On the next edition of Virginia Conversations, Obamacare, twerk, and a lot more. The new words of 2013. Until then, I'm May Lily Lee, wishing you a great week.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.